Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced in traditional territory of the Stalo Nation in Abbotsford, British Columbia, at CIVL 101.7 FM. I'll be your host today, Groundwire's National Coordinator, Glenn S. This episode, we're remembering Art Manuel, justice, advocacy, and issues facing young women in British Columbia, a discussion on sexual violence against the Asian communities at UBC, the BC Employment Standards Coalition, and an update on the Enbridge Line 9 water protectors. But first, here are the headlines. Our first headline comes from Common Law Radio and CFRO, Vancouver's Co-op Radio, speaking to Tracy McIntosh, the Director of Justice for Girls, about issues faced by young women in the province of BC.
So Justice for Girls was seeing that young women particularly are impacted by many different systems that adult women are not impacted by, the education system, the child welfare system, the health system, as well as the criminal justice system. There are different laws and policies that impact their lives. So Justice for Girls was wanting to address those issues in those young women's lives, especially young women that were not getting serviced by what already existed. Yeah, the Girls Advocacy and Education Center came out of a multi-year national project that was done by Justice for Girls and Dr. Jaskaran Dillon in 2005. It was looking at what are the barriers impeding young women's access, specifically young women who are homeless, young women who are street entrenched. Why aren't they in school? What's in their way? What can be done to ensure that they actually get the education? So they talked to women, actually three different cities across Canada, and out of that came a number of recommendations, and one of the recommendations was to create girls' alternative programs specifically. So actually I've been on the board of the Justice for Girls since 2008, and only have just recently actually started to work full-time. I've been a teacher with the Vancouver School Board in an alternative program for the last 15 years and with the school board for, I don't know, almost 30 years or something. But when I went back and did my master's in education, Justice for Girls approached me and said, could you look at what could this look like if we were to create an alternative program? What would it look like? So that's where the idea came. We decided to actually create a space for young women to come. And actually, the idea went from just an alternative program, and we realized quite early on that was too narrow, and we needed to increase it to look at encompassing all of the services that Justice for Girls already offers and put them under one roof and expand to include an educational supports to complete grade 12 as well. Really, the biggest barrier has been funding. Certainly, we've had enormous amount of support when we've gone out to the different youth-serving organizations, people in the community, politicians, people we've talked to have thought, yes, we really do need a more specified resource and support, especially around violence and exploitation for young women and girls. And we've had a lot of people supporting in terms of offering us space, helping us host focus groups, being willing to be interviewed by us, stakeholders from all different areas. And so, you know, the intention is to build it from the grassroots, from the ground up, and as opposed to a top-down model, and then to continue being informed by young women and by community stakeholders about what's needed. So yeah, funding really has been the biggest, you know, reestablishing Justice for Girls funding. We've always had a multi-year funding, and that was, you know, cut off. So now we're just reestablishing that. So once we get that, then we have the space, then things start to flow from there.
Our second headline comes from the Media Co-op and the Dominion podcast regarding the decision to drop charges against the Enbridge Line 9 water protectors. Last week in a Sarnia, Ontario courthouse, all criminal charges were dropped against Vanessa Gray, Stone Stewart, and Sarah Scanlon, the three individuals who allegedly shut down the Enbridge Line 9 tar sands and Bakken oil field near Sarnia on December 21, 2015. The most serious charge the three individuals were facing was mischief endangering a life, which carries a maximum sentence of life in prison. This charge was dropped because there was no chance of conviction. The Crown also indicated that it had consulted with Enbridge on this course of action. In December 2016, prior to the charges being dropped, water protector Vanessa Gray spoke with the Dominion podcast about the disproportionately harsh charge Vanessa, Stone, and Sarah received in reaction to the Line 9 actions.
It just made, like, us. The water protectors, the charges just make us look like criminals. Indigenous communities are, you know, not always in a place to continue fighting for our rights as Indigenous peoples. Court things are really expensive and risky when it comes to going against larger industries like Enbridge. And so I think that's why, like, a lot of Indigenous communities didn't, you know, go any further than going to National Energy Board and saying that this was not properly consulted. And once they overlook our rights, they can criminalize us for trying to assert our inherent rights to protect the land.
To finalize the dropping of the charges, the three defendants agreed to enter into a legally binding peace bond for 18 months. This means that the individuals agree not to act on Enbridge property and to keep the peace for the duration of the bond.
Our next headline comes from CJSF's Guerrilla Radio and includes David Ferry, the co-chair of the BC Employment Standards Coalition, discussing some of the difficulties posed to workers by BC employers.
Well, we're primarily interested in their experience and their story, where people can tell us their story, their experience, the challenges they've had anonymously, if they wish. They don't need to give their name. They don't even need to give their employer's name. But we are interested in collecting stories that will demonstrate that the need for improvements in the Employment Standards Act and the way in which it's enforced. One of the more common complaints and stories is that of being improperly terminated and not receiving any severance pay on termination, not being paid overtime is not being paid overtime for working longer than 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week is also a common complaint. A common complaint is about bullying and harassment in the workplace. Common complaint is unrealistic schedules, work schedules, and work demands, and having to work beyond the normal day on their own time, particularly, for example, in the high-tech sector, where people are paid a basic salary, if you will, or paid an hourly rate on the basis of an eight-hour day, but frequently are given impossible deadlines to meet and therefore are finding themselves having to work in the evenings or on weekends to meet impossible deadlines. Well, most people don't know most people don't know what their rights are from the beginning, right? They're not familiar with the Employment Standards Act, and many employers don't even know what's in the Employment Standards Act, in my experience. But of course, if there is any recrimination or disciplinary action resulting from an employee complaining about a violation of their rights, then that is prohibited under the law. So they could complain to the Employment Standards Branch if they feel that they are being discriminated against or being dealt with unfairly because of them complaining about violations of the law. Well, the Employment Standards Branch obviously have an obligation to enforce the Act and to process complaints. In the last decade or so, that's been very difficult because they've changed the process. They introduced the self-help kit, and they don't do anymore what we would call proactive investigations. That is, if there appears to be an employer, that if they've had a complaint about one employer where the violation might be actually systemic, that is, that there are more than just one worker affected by it, then the Employment Standards Branch used to engage in what they call proactive investigations. If they learned about a situation and they believed that the employer was doing this not just to one worker but to several workers, then they had the right, they have the power to go and investigate without there having been a complaint. So this is another change that we would like to see, is that there be better staffing for the Employment Standards Branch, and that they engage in proactive investigations. And they could do it on the basis of a sector or an area or a business. It seems to me it would be in the interests of employers in a particular sector or an area to make sure that everyone is complying, because those that aren't are getting an advantage, an unfair advantage, by exploiting workers more than others.
And that's it for the headlines. We'll be back right after this.
excuses to be cold, I refuse it. Throw my fears into the fire. When the sun, it came out today, I tried not to squint my eyes.
Just heard Wild Card by Kin, and you're listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at groundwirenews.ca. Now it's time for our feature stories. Our first feature comes from Al Soni and Golban Multaji from CHUO concerning the passing of Indigenous leader and activist Art Manuel.
In a public statement released on January 12, 2017, the Union of British Columbia Indian Chiefs announced the sudden and unexpected passing of Arthur Manuel. The UBCIC declared,
"On behalf of our elders, leaders, and chiefs, we offer our sincere sympathies and condolences to the Manuel family with respect to their tremendous loss."
An author and activist, Arthur Manuel worked nationally and internationally for Indigenous land and human rights. He served for many years as chief of the Nesconlanth Indian Band and was also member of the UBCIC's Chief Council.
Arthur Manuel was featured on Groundwire in 2013, speaking with CFBX and Kamloops.
The privileges that Canada and the provinces have enjoyed in terms of that mutual 100% exclusive control over all of Canada between federal and provincial governments, that is no longer a reality. It is an outdated, legally, constitutionally outdated concept, you know. When Canada was got its constitution patriated in 1982, Section 35(1) was put in there. Section 35(1) in the Canadian Constitution says that Canada, that's the government of Canada, and the provinces, that's all the provinces in this country, will recognize and affirm existing Aboriginal and treaty rights. Now, they had a conference that was set to happen under Section 37 to discuss, you know, Aboriginal constitutional matters. Now, those two provisions have to be read in tandem. They can't be read independently. Sure, one recognizes rights, but the other one was to define and broaden and shape those rights vis-a-vis the changing federal and provincial jurisdictions that that were offensive to Aboriginal treaty rights. That's what recognition and affirmation means. And it also means that Indigenous people have the right to form their own government under Section 35. It also means that we have proprietary interest in Aboriginal and treaty territories, not just the Indian reserves. There's a whole change there. You know, Britain got away with stealing our land in 1867 under the British North America Act, where they allocated all land and resources in Canada to the federal provincial governments. That's where the dispossession, the colonization, took place. And Section 35, when it was added in 1982, did away with that. That as the status quo, you know, and it should have changed. And that's what we're pushing at the international level, is that the failure of the constitutional conferences actually invokes Article 1 on self-determination of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which talks about self-determination on Indigenous people. In fact, the Human Rights Committee has already asked Canada, how are you implementing Article 1 on self-determination with regard to Indigenous people? So Canada is already on the hook on this thing.
That was Arthur Manuel speaking with Groundwire in 2013.
In memory of Arthur Manuel, the UBCIC states, Arthur's legacy will continue to reverberate throughout our ongoing Indigenous history for many, many generations to come.
To learn more about the activism of Arthur Manuel, one of Canada's strongest and most outspoken Indigenous leaders, listeners are invited to pick up his award-winning co-author 2015 publication, Unsettling Canada, A National Wake-Up Call.
This report was prepared for Groundwire by Gretchen King from CKUT in Montreal and presented by
Golban Multaji
and myself, Alan Sony, from CHUO in Ottawa.
And our second feature is from CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective, who talked to Dr. J.P. Katungal, a member of the Advisory Committee of UBC's Asian-Canadian Asian Migration Studies, about sexual violence against the Asian community on campus at UBC and beyond.
The ACAM Dialogue Series is a set of monthly events that is student-led that really attempts to create a space for conversations about sexual assault, about rape culture on campus in ways that are culturally appropriate. These kinds of dialogues are intersectional, which is to say that they take into account the fact that oppression or violence based on gender and sexuality are also cross-cut by experiences of race or migration or culture. So these dialogues, these monthly events, are meant to make space for these kinds of conversations in a way that centers also the leadership and the bodies and the experiences and the kind of cultural concepts of Asian communities, and especially Asian students of Asian descent. So part of this, this is part of a bigger conversation that's happening on campus, very important, necessary conversation around campus rape culture, around experiences of sexual and gender-based violence, as we experience it here as an institution. We put together, we envisioned this series of monthly dialogues as a way to ensure that these conversations do not sidestep the importance of culturally specific understandings and barriers and norms that shape how people experience gender and sexual violence. So that is partly why it's important to give color, as it were, to give more meaningful context and certainly a kind of more grounded, culturally grounded conversation about how to deal with these issues that are very important, because we know that they do not affect everyone the same. Right, and they do not manifest in the same way. UBC was having all sorts of very public conversations and very important ones about the fact that as a campus, along with other campuses in North America, we have an intense problem of campus rape culture. And an ongoing one, dating from the kind of rape chants from orientation from a few years ago to the revelations by the CBC report around, a graduate student, a set of graduate students and their experiences of gender violence. So at that time, UBC, as an institution, was trying to respond. And was therefore encouraging efforts from the kind of constituency within UBC to respond in their own ways. And so Chris Lee and I decided to think together about what we might do from the perspective of Asian Canadian communities, because we also believe that these conversations cannot happen without centering that cultural appropriate kind of philosophy. And that was how this effort was born, is the confluence of both this one-time event and this broader conversation that was happening on campus.
You're listening to Groundwire Community News, broadcasting from coast to coast to coast, available online at groundwirenews.ca. It's time for our community radio report, and this week's report's about CIVL Radio's Creative Dialogue Project, which seeks to support, discuss, and share the experiences, projects, and hardships faced by marginalized groups in CIVL's community of the Fraser Valley. The project will be managed by Gordon Caddick from the Vancouver-based radio documentary team Cited. This project will include workshops, a speaker series, and will be running until March 30th. Hopes are that the Creative Dialogue Project will increase CIVL's relationship with the diverse communities of the Fraser Valley, as well as strengthen relationships between marginalized communities there. In addition to this, the project will also provide journalistic training for community members and station volunteers to aid them in producing and critically analyzing news in the modern media.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Saturday Rain by Indrift here on Groundwire Radio News. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on traditional territory of the Stalo Nation in Abbotsford, B.C. Headlines this week come from Ome Salma Rahimtula, CJSF's Guerrilla Radio, CFRO's Common Law Radio. Features this week were by Al Soni and Golban Moltaji from CHUO and CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective. Groundwire would like to thank all of its contributors, as well as invite you to contribute to our next episode. You can listen to Groundwire on your local community radio station, as well as online at groundwirenews.ca.